Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of the recently released novel, Who by Fire. My guest today is the evocative poet, Sarah C. Harwell, and I have reason to believe I might get my fortune told. More on this shortly. Sarah Harwell is the Associate Director of Syracuse University's MFA program in creative writing. I think it's a good guess that after this interview, we'll all be trying to wrangle a way into one of her classes. She's deeply read and teaches both fiction and poetry, writing it and reading it. In fiction, Kafka, Zora Neale Hurston, Flannery O'Connor, Alice Munro, and Marilyn Robinson, and the poets she loves and teaches include Seamus Heaney, Tom Slay, Heather McHugh, Shakespeare, Gerard Manley Hopkins, Philip Larkin, and Wallace Stevens, to name just some, all my favorites. I'm a fiction writer who believes that poetry is the answer. Okay, poetry and love, all caps, are the answer. Sarah Harwell's journey has included jobs as waitress, librarian, that one figures, but get this, listeners, also telephone psychic, astrologer, and tarot reader. In one of her poems, the speaker says, "I have the number of a psychic, but when I phone, I answer." I can't wait to talk to her because I've read her book of poems, Sit Down Traveler, where she explores life, love big time, the good, the hard, and the unpredictability of it all, and where the tarot cards are her guide and ours throughout the collection. We haven't met, but in our brief correspondence, she's assured me that she's a, quote, late-blooming writer. I'm not so sure about that, but be assured, she's bloomed. She's won the Joyce Carol Oates Prize in Poetry and the Delmore Schwartz Poetry Prize for Best Poem. Her poems have appeared in the distinguished literary magazines Poetry, Margie, and Tri-Quarterly, among others, and the Washington Post published one of my favorite poems in Sit Down Traveler, The Dead. We've got to find out how that happened. She was born in Nashville, Tennessee. Sarah C. Harwell, welcome to Rare Bird Radio.
Thanks very much, Mary. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, before I ask you, I would like to say how happy I am to have you here. Before I ask you about the role of the tarot cards as a thematic hold on the collection, and by the way, I think the tarot card poems are incredibly effective. You must tell us about your job as a telephone psychic so we get that out of the way.
Yes, I understand, because most people have not been a telephone psychic. So it's very, very often the thing that people really want to know about. I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and my daughter was probably a couple months old, and she, we needed the money, and I didn't want to go back to work as, I didn't want to leave her. So I thought, well, what can I do? And I don't know if you've ever been to Santa Fe, New Mexico, but there are a lot of people. You have?
I have been there.
So there's a lot of interest in alternative spirituality there. So
right.
There was an ad in the paper looking for a telephone psychic. So I answered it, and I thought, this is the perfect job. I had done tarot readings for people for several years before that, and I had studied astrology there, and I interviewed. I had to give a reading, and they said, great. Yes, they actually interview you. but they don't ask the normal questions. So,
Can you give us an example of what they ask?
Well, you know, it was a long time ago, and what I remember is giving a reading for the, she said, well, sit down and give me a reading about, and I think she said something about her, she wanted to know about her money situation. And so I spent time. Yes, exactly. Well, actually, no. Most people don't care about their money situation. It was funny when I actually became a telephone psychic, all the questions were, can you guess? What were the questions about? Oh, what do you think?
My gift.
Yes.
Am I going to fall in love? Is this guy going to leave me?
Exactly.
Is this gal going to dump
That's
me?
Right.
Is he betraying me?
That's exactly right. See, that was what everybody wanted to know. But she wanted to know about money. So I gave her the reading, whatever the cards came up with. I think it was pretty good. I think she was doing quite well as a – she was a telephone psychic as well. So she was doing quite well. So I ended up getting the job, and it's one of those jobs that you can stay at home, and at a certain time you're on, and people phone in. And I lasted 3 days, I think. I was not a long-term telephone psychic.
I once had a job as a cold-calling salesperson. I lasted a half a day.
That's worse. That's definitely worse.
I was no good at it, I can tell you.
Sarah, I have
a question on the Goodreads book club that you generously joined, where someone asked whether you have unique perception or sensitivity.
Well, it's a good question.
Let me say this quickly. Already having read your poems, I answer yes to that. But what is your answer to that?
Well, the way I use the cards... the cards are, they tell a story. So in a way, it's a lot like writing. You know, you throw the cards and you tell a story. So your perception in the cards is the story you tell. But I'm not psychic. And I often don't think the cards really tell a set future, but they tell patterns in your life, and most of the time they tell you something that you already know, but maybe you're not sure about, or you're not clear in your mind. So, I mean, that's how I use them. They did tell me once they had a very strong direction, and they told me to come to Syracuse, which is where I was. I have been now for 13 years. So yes, they did. And I kept throwing them again and again, saying, no, I don't want to go to Syracuse. But they kept saying, and I did end up here, and it's been a very good place for me. So I don't know.
I want to turn to the poems. And for our listeners, there are 18 poems in the collection that are titled with the term Major Arcana, which, as I understand it, and Sarah will correct me, is the trump card in the set of cards. And I have a couple of questions about the way the poems work throughout the collection, Sarah.
Sure.
My first question is just a clarification one. The first poem is titled Major Arcana Future. And you do mention the full, I've done a little research on this. I don't know anything about these cards myself, but I see that the Fool is maybe the number one, and I know that is referenced inside the poem. Is this the first card for you, for the first poem?
Yes, the first card is the Fool. It's a zero in the numbering system, and this one was based, loosely based or used as a meditation for this particular poem called Your Future.
Okay. Then what I want to ask you is, the fact that I went through all the poems, because there are, that makes them 18. So now we have 18
right.
out of 22 major arcana poems. You leave out
yes.
three. So you left
yes.
out the Hermit, you uh-huh. left out Justice, and you
uh-huh.
left out Death.
Right.
Why?
Well, you're very perceptive, and I don't have a really good answer, except that when I got my book accepted, those were the three poems they wanted to cut. So I do have those poems, but
oh, wow.
they did not want to publish them. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So, and I thought, well, you know, it's actually kind of interesting without, you know, Death.
Yeah,
I kind of liked it, but I have them. I have them in my computer, and they're still around. So it's all of them.
That is really not the answer I expected. That is so cool.
I know you thought you thought I had a reason.
Yeah, so. I think we all want to read those three poems. I'm telling you, this collection is definitely one that will haunt you. You want to read it again and again. So I have a question related to this, and if I'm off base, you just hit me in the chops here.
Okay.
And this one comes from my rereading and rereading of this collection, which has been haunting me. In the first one of Eliot, you don't list T.S. Eliot. You don't list on your website as one of your favorite poems. A poet, so I just am going here on my own dangerous territory. One of Eliot's most quoted lines, which is from The Wasteland and from What the Thunder Said, is "These fragments I have shored against my ruins," and gets quoted a lot here and there. You find it again and again. In your first poem, you do say, in the first poem, Major Arcana Future, "Our life was built on ruins, on top of ruins, as the sun set off on an unfamiliar cliff." Am I hearing an Eliot allusion here or not?
You actually, Eliot is one of my favorite poets. I know. Now I have to go back and put him on. And yes, there is a bit of an allusion to Eliot. And as well, there's an allusion to there's a tarot garden in an actual garden of tarot sculptures in Italy. And it's done by Nikki de Saint Fiel, and I'm probably massacring her name. And she's an artist, and I went and visited it, and that's one of the reasons the poems are often use fragments in them, because they were mosaics. The sculptures are all mosaics. So that's part of it. But yes, there is a T.S. Eliot echo, I guess I would call it, in that particular line.
And you're not just
good reading. No, I'm not. I'm not nice at all.
Oh, I don't believe that for a second. You know, one of the poems that I did mention in the intro is the poem that got into the Washington Post. And before you even tell us how that happened, and I've Googled around enough to figure out to find it in the Washington Post.
Right.
So I've actually read the introduction to it and such, but I would like our listeners to actually hear the voice of this beautiful poet. And I really think you're not only physically beautiful, but you really write beautifully, Sarah. Could you read this poem to us? It's on page 18 of your book, if you have it in front of you.
I do, and I'd be happy to. This is a poem I wrote for my daughter, and the title of it is Dead. The way my daughter sleeps, it's as if she's talking to the dead. Now she is one. I watch her eyes roll backwards in her head, her senses fold one by one, and then her breathing quiets to a beat. Every night she fights this silent way of being with all the whining ammunition that she has. She wins a tired story, a smothered song, the small and willful links to life that carry her away. Welcome to the Egyptian burial. She's gone to Hades with her stuffed animals. When she wakes, the sad circles disappeared. She blinks before she knows me. I have listened to 1 million breaths of her. And every night, my body seizes when she leaves to go where I am not, and yet every night I urge her, go.
I read this poem, Sarah, and I found it to be so not only brave, but it moved me to tears. And I want to tell you why. I have two children, and now I have a grandchild. Mm-hmm. And somehow, you know, I remember in their infancy standing by their beds and, you know, hoping that they would fall asleep and so on, but being so afraid that they wouldn't wake.
Right.
There's a sort of burden of motherhood in this poem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly what I was feeling at the time I wrote it. I remember writing it. My daughter, she was older, I think 6 or 7, and she was sleeping beside me in my bed, and I was writing poetry. So,
how old is she now?
She's 17. So
oh, wow.
She's almost out of the house.
About ready to go to college.
Yeah, we just applied to a lot of colleges. So.
Oh, you're in
when
that
we,
process.
Yes, yes. It's really terrible.
I know. Having been through it, I know.
Yeah.
We worry with them all the way through it, don't we?
I think so, yeah. It's really stressful. So, but I guess it's good stress, sort of, most days.
Right, right. Well, clearly you love this child, and that comes through in the poem in this very edgy way. Before we get to, I want to talk to you about the question of love. Before we get to it, why don't you give us a little of the story of how, you know, a young woman who's born in Nashville, Tennessee, ends up in the Washington Post.
Well, I went to school. I'd gone back to school originally to library school to get a job, and I got a job at Syracuse University as a research librarian, researching digital libraries. And then I got into the – I'd always wanted to write, and I got into the MFA program. And I got in because I had taken a course with Mary Carr, and she was my teacher for 3 years, along with a bunch of other great poets. And she was doing a column in the Washington Post after I had graduated, and she loved that particular poem that I had written it in school, and so she asked if she could, you know, write about it. So she did.
Oh,
it was
wonderful.
Very odd. It was
well,
really
how
nice.
Wonderful. And it's also, it was my favorite. It appeared in a column, since I did some research on this, it appeared in a column called Poet's Choice. It's a column that, along with the Washington Post book review that has disappeared, sadly, has that column.
Yeah,
and that's been a great loss for me.
I agree. I think it's really sad. There's not as the venues for poetry get smaller and smaller. You really have to search it out, I guess.
And that was so wonderful. I think Robert Haas may be the first one who did he was the first poet laureate, and I think he began it. I might have that wrong, but I think he did.
It might have been him, or there was Robert Pinsky. I think he did it for a while. And then Mary did it. Yeah,
terrific.
So, some great poets have done it, and I wish it was still
around. I know. Well, we're putting.
Well, you live in Washington.
Yeah, we're putting in the plug here for anybody who's listening.
That's
we want
right.
it back.
That's right.
If you have a position on love, and I don't know if that's possible to have a position on love. If one can have a position on love, let me give you mine first. Love is the answer, but what is the question? Is my position.
It's a pretty good position.
what would you say your position on love is?
Well, I think when I was younger, I believed all the things they said about it, that it was possible to love somebody in a kind of grand manner. And I think my life has been, and I think that's still possible, but it's never going to look the way you think it's going to look. I think love is really complicated and wonderful and, it's like a plant. It's organic, and it grows, and it dies, and it grows again. And I'm not making any sense here, but it's a complicated
endeavor. Yes, you are.
Endeavor.
Yes, you are. No, you are. You are making sense.
It's just a really much more complicated thing than I was led to believe at age 12. So, and I think that it's. The thing that we think of as love is often, you know, the first 6 months, and then it goes away, and then the hard work starts. And I think it's totally worth it. I'm in love right at this very minute, and I'm very happy. But I think it's not an end thing. And I always like when somebody says something like, you know, I think it actually was Mary Carr who said this, or maybe somebody else, but that often people ask, why am I not loved? When the question is really, why do I not love? So I think we need to keep that in mind, that it's an active process, I guess. That we need to do in the world. everybody.
I'm going to read a line from Cloud Cover right here. The Cloud Cover is one of the poems in the book. In Cloud Cover, the speaker says, "I was seized, kidnapped by, I hate to even tell you, so stupid, but it felt something like love." And I think that strikes me, Sarah, as kind of a reference to the early sort of feeling of, you know, that's what we think is the answer in a way, to be seized, kidnapped, you know, by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
When the long term is a lot different.
It is. It's a lot different. It has a many, many, many more varieties of feelings. And so, I think you mean seized and kidnapped. And that's a beautiful, wonderful feeling. But you have many more feelings before your relationship is finished. So,
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, obviously, a lot of my poems came out of my my own kind of musing about love after I got a divorce or as I was going through the process. So that's some of the book has to do with that in a kind of oblique way, I would think.
I didn't want to ask that question, but I had a sense that there had been a broken marriage somewhere along here and here, but I didn't want to go there because I don't want to ask any. I don't like to ask questions that embarrass people or make thought that they want to talk about. But what I'd like to do here is go out on a limb a little bit more on my end and tell you something else that this whole collection did to me. I mean, if you can believe what I've been reading, you know, a rereading of The Wasteland. There's been that, and then there's been. This is a real stretch, so you're going to have to just hang in there with me. And if I'm going to give you a chance to tell me I'm totally off base before I before I dig my hole too deeply here.
Okay.
Okay. So, on reading all the poems more than once, and I will again say, listeners, this collection demands that. Kafka's The Trial resonated for me. Now, I want you to stop me now if I'm way off base.
Wow.
If I'm not way off base,
wow.
I'll tell you why. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm not way off base, or?
Well, I'm not sure. That's interesting. I've read The Trial, and I love The Trial. And if it got into this particular collection, I think I might have, it would be more of an unconscious reference.
Let me tell you what happened to me here. So here's what happened to me. In the first poem, I read Major Arcana, Your Future, and you do this really unusual thing all through the book. You introduce a dog in this poem. You say, a man fed the dog bones. What fool would predict dogs don't choke on bones? Okay, so there I've got a dog inside a poem about the Major Arcana, the fool, okay?
Right.
And then and this isn't the only one where there's a dog, but let's just go to the last poem. The last Major Arcana poem is also the last major card, world.
Right, right.
And in that poem, we get a dog again. And in this one, let me see if I can find that. You say, all she saw were dogs, dogs barking, howling, dogs making love on the streets, dogs eating bones they shouldn't eat. Okay, now here's where I went with all of this. I went to the fact that at the end of the trial, we have Kay, and he goes to his execution without even a fair trial or even a real trial without a lawyer, and his last words are like a dog. And here's my question. You may not have had this in your mind at all, but my question is, aren't you in some way arguing about the Major Arcana cards and the nature of the future, and is it predictable? And perhaps, talk to me about that.
Well, that's exactly what I'm doing. Yes, no, that's exactly what I was trying. Were you an English? You were like an English teacher, weren't you? That's exactly what I was trying to. As much as I use the cards to predict the future, at the same time, there's always a part of me that goes, "This isn't the future," you know. And And we always want to know the future, and the world is a scary place, and we actually do know the future because we're all going to die. So I think that my looking at the cards is really trying to, in these poems, is trying to say I did not know the future. You know, life was turned out quite different than I expected. I'm arguing with the idea of fate, I guess, the actual cards. I'm arguing with the idea of people's desire to want to know the future, my own, and the people. But also at the same time, I understand and kind of covet the comfort that the cards and knowing the future will bring. It gives me a sense of relief when I throw the cards, because I think, oh, well, you know, that horrible thing that I'm afraid is going to happen won't happen, or whatever. And I think vulnerable as human beings, I mean, we're so vulnerable in the world. We're vulnerable because our bodies are so soft, and we know so much and so little at the same time, and we're so scared. I definitely understand why people go towards psychics or religion or whatever it is, but at the same time, there's always this rational side of me going, yes, but, you know, maybe it's none of this. And trying to find beauty in that, and trying to find kind of comfort in that as well. So I guess the major arcana cards are actually, the poems in the book are actually my kind of exploration of that.
And they sort of represent a kind of question mark. That's how it struck me, as a kind of question mark all through the book.
Yes, yes. I don't know the answer. I really wish I did, but I don't. So, I think the question for me is interesting, you know, and seeing how that all my fears and my questionings and my emotions have played out throughout my own life, and then watching people who I've given readings to, and watching how their lives have played out, and I just think it's really an interesting kind of question.
You know, as we're kind of coming to the end of our time together here, but before we do, mm-hmm. I just want to talk to you about Neruda, Pablo Neruda,
mm-hmm.
because you in the poem The Stranger, you quote. I think. Am I safe to say that we're both lovers of Pablo Neruda?
I love Pablo Neruda.
I love him. I am like mad about him. I mean, I have all the love poems and the Song of Desperation. I have them all, including I have a really bad translation of the line that you quote at the beginning of the poem The Stranger. You quote the line, "My heart is late and shoreless," and actually the Spanish for that is "Mi corazón es tarde y sin orillas," and I think that's a fabulous translation. If you can believe this, my translation says, love, it grows late and the shorelines are lost. Isn't that awful?
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's terrible.
I know.
Oh,
I'm not going to say
well,
who did it.
Don't.
Who did it. Yeah,
but
translations are really interesting.
They are. I love, sometimes I just look at 7 or 8 of them, of the same poem at once. I just think it's really fascinating.
It's true. And as we close here, I'm wondering if there is anything is there a question I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
I have no idea.
Maybe I've done a pretty good job.
You've done a pretty good job. I didn't know what you were going to ask, so this is very good. I just want to thank you so much for doing this. This is very kind, and it was really fun to talk to you.
Well, I want to close in this way, because I think mm-hmm. we are both lovers of Neruda. I'd like to mm-hmm. close with these lines, translated most beautifully by W.S. Merwin, from Neruda's Tonight I Can Write. And he says, he translates Pablo this way. We'll call him by his first name. In the distance, someone's singing. Sarah C. Harwell, your poems stay with me in just that way, like singing. I thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank
you,
Mary.
You're so welcome.
All right.
Goodbye, dear.
Goodbye.
Without a hand to hold, but it's all right. I'm okay. How are you? For what it's worth, I must say I love you. And in my bed late at night, I miss you. Someone is gonna save my heart. No one is gonna break my everything around me turned to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand, and I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright. I'm okay. I wanna know how you are and what it's. But everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing. And I lift myself way off the ground. Yeah, but it's all.